Blog Talk Radio.
The Bible tells me I was made for and from man, and I must do for him everything that I can. I must surrender to his will, yeah, I must submit. I can't make the household decisions, cause I am unfit. It tells me my place with everlasting grace. The Bible tells me I must be silent, you can't hear my voice. My role has been divinely defined, and I have no other choice. I may not be a teacher of men, I must cover up my shame. These are the laws of the one who in vain I cannot name. He tells me my place with everlasting grace. Am I punishment for wanting to learn? It's a painful birth from which I may not return. The Bible tells me that I am unclean. I am impure, you cannot touch me. And it has nothing to do with where I've been. It is part of who I am. It is because I corrupt men. I was asking for this just by being a woman. He tells me my place with everlasting grace. Am I punishment for wanting to learn? It's a painful birth from which I may not return.
Welcome to Fire Talk Productions. My guest today is David G. McAfee. He is a journalist, a religious studies scholar, and author of Disapproving Christianity and Other Secular Writings, as well as his new book, Mom, Dad, I'm an Atheist, The Guide to Coming Out as a Non-Believer. Please welcome him to the show.
Hey, David, are you there?
Thank you for having me. Yep, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome to the show. That opening song for everyone was Shelley Segal. And you can find her on Facebook as well and YouTube. Please check it out. That song's name was Eve. David, can you tell us more about yourself?
Yep, I'm 23 years old, based in Los Angeles. I just published my second book, Mom, Dad, I'm an Atheist, The Guide to Coming Out as a Non-Believer. I majored in religious studies at University of California, Santa Barbara, and I graduated 2 years ago. So this is the first book post-graduation, and looking forward to writing a lot more in the future.
Now, why did you write this book?
I wrote this book because I realized that even though my family realized that I was an atheist really when I was very young, around 13 years old, I realized that people still have problems with coming out as an atheist, whether it's in their personal, their family relationships, or whether it's in their educational lives, social lives, professional lives. It's something that can really affect every part of your life. And in America and in a lot of countries where religion and theism are the assumed places to start, then it becomes a problem. So I decided to write it to help out people who might be in that same situation, experiencing atheist discrimination or otherwise just finding it difficult to admit that they don't believe.
I love the way you lay your book out. It definitely gives people the tools they need to come out, because everybody seems to be on their own place in the spectrum, from all the way atheist to never believed, to a lot of different variations, as you've found, I'm sure, in your work.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And as I tell in the book, I've never been a believer, and I've been an atheist my entire life, but that doesn't make me immune from having to come out, because religion and theism are assumed to be the default settings, when, in fact, that should be the opposite.
Now, when you say it should be opposite, what do you mean?
I mean that atheism is the default setting, that nobody would be religious if they weren't introduced to those concepts, those scriptures, those doctrines. Nobody would become a Christian specifically or a Muslim specifically without all of that. They would may feel that there should be a designer or something vague like that, but without those ancient doctrines, without the archaic scriptures, there's really nothing that ties religion to humanity. So without all that, we would just continue to be agnostic atheists or then make our own opinions from there. But it wouldn't involve Christian God. It wouldn't involve Jesus or walking on water or anything like that.
No, and you see that when you go to different places who's had no exposure to it. They've created
yep.
whatever God within their world they believe in.
Yep, and in the beginning, that's how all religions started, where people just, their best guesses trying to explain the unknown of that time period, but people don't understand that at a certain point, once you can explain those things, then we can cast those things aside and work with science as opposed to religion.
Why do you think people need a God as opposed to just believing in our own ability to do things?
People need God think that they need God for different reasons, and there are therapeutic benefits to spirituality, but it's not something that can't be offered by traditional therapies. So, in my opinion, when people use God or any religion, any religious idol really, to say that it makes their life better or it helps them solve problems, anything like that, it just sounds to me as though they're trying to escape those problems, because if you leave
right.
it up to God, nothing's going to happen.
Well, and as an atheist, when you're trying to solve a problem with a religious person, it can be a very difficult conversation, because they're giving it over to someone, where me as a non-believer, I have to actually figure out what can I do within the scope of my ability to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to think from a real-world perspective, actually trying to solve problems as opposed to praying or leaving it up to God or some other higher power. And realistically, there's more results there. And as I say on my page all the time, if for every well-intended prayer uttered in hopes of making the world a better place, there's instead a good deed accomplished, the world might actually look as though those prayers had been answered. So it's like, it would just be a self-fulfilling prophecy if people ignored that.
Yeah, to me, the only benefit of prayer is kind of in the concept of the power of positive thinking. So
mm-hmm.
visualizing what you want, to me, isn't a bad thing to help manifest it. But if you don't connect action to it and you put the responsibility of creating that outside of you, then that kills the concept of what you really want to happen in my mind.
I couldn't agree more.
So, tell me more about your education. For a person who's never believed, why have you chosen this path of education and this topic to devote so much of your life to?
Of course, a lot of people ask that. I started when I was around 13 years old. I was going to church with my family pretty regularly, and I had never taken it seriously as a kid, so I was already a non-believer. But I started to get a little more active. I started to be more open about my non-belief. I started to actually attend church more often because I was interested in finding out why my family believed what they did. So I would go to church with them. I went to church with other friends. I went to synagogues and some other Christian sects. I went to a bunch of different religious organizations, and just to try to learn why they all believe these things and why they believe such different things and why within those beliefs they have their own contradictions. So I also read the Bible by about age 15. So when I told my family and friends that I was going to study religion in college, it wasn't something that they were surprised about. Everyone seemed kind of like that was the obvious next step for me, was to go and study religion from a phenomenological approach, from a historical approach, and kind of learn about religion side by side, as opposed to studying theology, where you learn essentially from that religion's perspective. So when I went to UCSB, I studied religion from that perspective, and I don't regret it for a minute. I plan on continuing my education in that realm for master's, PhD programs as well.
Now, the majority of people within that program are normally Christians, correct?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, there were a few non-believers that I was able to talk to as well, but majority of people in there were Christian, and that was actually not great for them, because they would find that we were learning about the Christian creation myth right alongside Hindu creation myths and Native American creation myths, and that did not make them very happy.
No, I could see where that would be a problem, because there is a lot of commonality between all of them, correct?
Oh, yeah, there's a ton. There's, a lot of the stories in the Bible are replicated in other areas. In other regions, and people, a lot of Christians might say that that's God trying to inspire those other areas, or I don't know exactly all the arguments.
Yeah,
I've heard those kind of things.
Where he's bringing it to them in a way that they will understand.
Realistically and anthropologically, you can look at how they formed and how they interacted, and when warriors from one area went to another area for combat, they would come back with that area's customs and kind of mix them in and mingle them in. So a lot of the narratives are similar. Even when they didn't interact, they are similar, though. Like flood myths are really popular, and creation myths often are very similar, just because when you're imagining how things are created in Bronze Age times, you're going to have similar ideas, and it all starts with some being that had to have put you there because they couldn't understand how it could have happened otherwise.
You know, I saw something about the flood part of the story, and it's called it the single greatest act of genocide.
People
focus on, well, they gather two of each animal, so to speak, even if that was possible. But then you're like, okay, so then everything else on Earth drowned? Is that what we're getting out of this children's story?
And that's not even reading into it. I mean, it says those words that everything died. It's just the logistics of it don't make enough sense to debate it too further.
Right. I don't know why zoos are spending so much time making it so complex when all they need is just a big boat.
Exactly. you would think that a zoo that's 4 or 5 times bigger than Noah's Ark was supposed to have been would be able to carry the same amount of animals, but for some reason that's just not possible.
It's poor spatial management, I think.
Yeah, they need to take a lesson out of the Bible for sure.
So when people see that you don't believe, and they're generally studying this because they want to develop a path to be a preacher or be What do they normally do with this type of education?
Well, normally a preacher or a minister or something like that would go through a theology program. So they're studying the religion from the religion's perspective as the true word of God or Christ or whatever. In religious studies, it wouldn't be – I'm sure I could go on and apply to minister-preacher programs and go through that and go that route. But most people who are in religious studies won't go that route just because it's not – teaching Christianity as the correct religion. It's teaching religion's history, and a lot of it works against that. So, for example, in some of my classes on New Testament scripture, we would actually learn about the contradictions in the Bible and learn about how the Gospels don't line up and talk about why that is and how a few of them don't mention the virgin birth, for example. There are a lot of things in there that if you're a Christian and you're studying religion, which is exactly why I recommend religious studies to almost everyone that I'm talking to about this, because it's difficult to believe if you have studied the religion and realize how similar
they are. You really broke
it
down. Now, do you watch people go from a very strong believer to questioning at the end of it?
Through the religious studies program, not really. I didn't interact with anybody enough to get that. To get that close to it. A lot of people would just express their anger when they were presented
challenged
with issues with their faith. Yeah, it wasn't as though they were then spurred to think critically about it. It was most of the time they just said, well, there's no contradictions in the Gospels, and then that was the end of it.
Why do you think people's reasoning is shut down when it comes to religion? Is it early indoctrination, or what do you think mentally happens?
Yeah, well, that's definitely most of the time that's the case. Is these are things that have been told to these people for their entire lives, most of the time since childhood, by the only people that they ever could trust, their parents, their family. It's not surprising that people believe when they're raised in those circumstances. I was raised in those circumstances and happened to not believe it, but that doesn't mean that I'm different than anyone else who did. It just means that I happen to not pick it up and just not take it seriously. But if you're raised and you're forced into it as a young child, it's hard. It's really hard to escape that. And it becomes second nature such that it doesn't factor into your logical thinking. It's just something that's assumed part of you, and you have no reason to doubt it, because why would your parents lie to you? It doesn't seem as though it's not a natural thing to question what they've told you your entire life, but I'm trying to change that. And a lot of
Not even seeing sometimes where people have ever questioned it. Like, a lot of people I see in church don't know what the Bible actually says, haven't read it, and really haven't thought a lot about what their belief system is, like you have challenged every aspect of yours. But they don't. They just go along.
Yes, in Disproving Christianity, I talk about those types of Christians, which I generally call cultural Christians. Those are people that have been Christians their entire lives but have never really thought about it, not even just questioned it or thought critically about it, but not even thought about the religion itself. Like you're saying, they haven't read the Bible, they don't know the tenets, they don't know the precepts, but they're still going to follow it because it's something that they've known all their life. It's something they're familiar with. Their family, their friends do it, and it's something that they're not going to question unless something drastic happens, unless someone becomes an open or public atheist around them and talks to them about it.
Well, when you start to question things and your whole community is Christian-based, there's a behavior pattern that automatically seems to be activated with Christians, where they start bringing you back in line if you challenge their doctrine. So have you seen that type of thing as well?
I'm sorry, they do what?
They bring you back in line, like other Christians kind of turn on you and start telling you that you need to believe and not question God and have faith and all the different things they say, to bring you back in line when you start to question or challenge their belief system.
Yeah, well, I not coming from a Christian community, didn't experience that. But in the book, I have testimonials from people who, I think 3 out of the 6 testimonials are based in Texas. They're people who have very Christian communities, and they've reported basically that same thing, and they're talking about their interactions with other Christians in their community in those testimonials. So because I wasn't raised in a super Christian community and I was never a believer, I thought it was important to include those testimonials for people who might be more relatable to their stories because it might be similar. So they kind of span the racial, political, and geographical spectrums there.
Yeah, I've seen very religious communities, obviously being from the South, and that is very much true. Everything that you do, they stay within a Christian network. So your friends and a lot of times your jobs and different things are all built on all that. And when you start questioning, not only are you losing the God you believed in, but you're also losing your friends and family and all those things. So you really have to be committed and when you're challenging it, because they will come at you full force with guilt and all types of things, including burning in hell.
Yep, and in those instances when a religious person is in a very religious community and they leave the church or they become an atheist, they have a hole where that sense of community was. So I do talk about establishing a new sense of community in the book, talking about getting in touch with local secular groups, local freethinker groups, and having like-minded friends is just beneficial for all non-believers, but especially for those whose family are unsupportive or who come from those super religious communities, because you're trying to fill that void. And with all the new groups that are popping up every day and online organizations, they're really stepping up the game to kind of fill that.
Yeah, because before, I think suicide was a big problem. The more and more people got isolated. So the social media is so important that it gives you sources, like you've listed numerous sources in your book, to how to build your community. You can go right down those sources and be able to start interacting and figure out where you fall in the spectrum. So, which I'm very glad that you put this information out. Now let's talk about the word atheist. Why does it have such a reaction, even people who call themselves non-believers, why are they hesitant to use the word atheist?
There are a lot of reasons, but historically the stigma with atheists the word atheist is going to be difficult to overcome. There are a lot of people who associate the word atheism with devil worship, with black magic, with essentially everything. I've heard essentially every name in the book thrown at me. But it all comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of what atheism is. So I go through in the book trying to dispel some of the myths about atheism and talk about the fact that we only really share one commonality, and that's a lack of belief in gods. And anything else is added and is not necessarily relevant to all non-believers, not all atheists.
Right.
So there are a lot of people who will try to go out of their way to misidentify themselves or to avoid using the word atheist because of that. And I'm trying to go the opposite route. I'm trying to really own the word atheist, because although I don't enjoy extra labels that aren't necessary, that is a label that does define me, and I'm not going to say that it doesn't just because it makes other people uncomfortable.
Now, you described it as herding cats. Is that correct?
That's actually a Richard Dawkins quote that I put in the book. Where he says, indeed, organizing atheists has been compared to herding cats because they tend to think independently and will not conform to authority. But a good first step would be to build up a critical mass of those willing to come out, thereby encouraging others to do so. Even if they can't be herded, cats in sufficient numbers can make a lot of noise and cannot be ignored. And that was in The God Delusion. And when I read that quote, I thought it really applied to the book, and so I wanted to put it at the top of the chapter for establishing a new sense of community.
Exactly. And that is true. It's very diverse. Now, when you list the different ones, where you say, like, atheist, agnostic, free thinker, non-believer, now, why is there so many different categories to cover all of
those? In most of those, it's because people are seeking other ways to define themselves other than atheist because of the negative connotations that come with it. So a lot of words that people have created, like bright and free thinker and non-believer, unbeliever. I put a lot in the book where people are trying to come at it from a more positive angle. Agnostic
yeah,
is misapplied.
Yeah, a softer version of it.
Agnostic is misapplied because it's not mutually exclusive with atheist. I, for example, am an agnostic atheist. I just call myself an atheist because I feel like everyone's agnostic. Nobody knows for sure anything. So anything regarding deities, anything could be possible. So in my opinion, everyone's an agnostic. I just call myself an atheist just because I don't believe in gods. And anyone who doesn't believe in gods is an atheist. And so getting people to realize that is kind of the first step there.
Well, now tell us more about why it's important for people to come out and reclaim that and to show what numbers we're talking about. Because church attendance has been on a rapid decline, right?
Yeah, well, coming out is extremely important, and no survey accurately represents the number of atheists, the number of non-believers, because some people don't know that they're atheists simply because they don't know what the word means. Some people are afraid to identify themselves as that because of external pressure or even a fear that God might be real and they're just hedging their bets. So there are a lot of reasons why our numbers aren't properly recorded in most surveys. But if people come out, that changes, and people, politicians, people in power, see that there's a growing minority that needs to be handled and needs to be dealt with, and our issues need to be addressed, especially regarding the separation of church and state. So it really helps people on a broader scale, but coming out also helps individuals, because the more people who come out as an atheist, other people realize that that's okay, and people who might have been in the closet or on the fence about their religion, and they now see that it's okay, they see that their friend or their family member is also non-religious. So it really does a lot to encourage others, too.
What about within your marriage, when you decide you don't believe but your spouse does? How do you handle stuff like that?
Yeah, again, that's a situation that I personally have never had to deal with, because my girlfriend's an atheist, and most people I interact with actually are. But in the book, I do have actually two testimonials from people who were married, who were atheists married to a believer, and they talk about how they dealt with that situation. And both are completely different instances, so it's good to have that variety in there.
Absolutely.
But they each give their types of advice. And in one situation, they're still happily married, Christian atheist. In the other situation, they're now both atheists, so that ended up well for them.
Yeah, it depends on how religious the person is, both people are, or were to begin with.
Yep, there are definitely a ton of factors.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It can be a very complex thing. Well, how do you convince someone that there is no hell when they feared it so much their whole life?
For me, it's not about convincing anyone of anything. I just ask for evidence. So if someone tells me I'm going to burn in hell, I'm going to ask for where's the evidence that this hell exists and where's the evidence that I'm going there, and they're not. Because if you look at scripture, I mean, depending on the religion and depending on the sect, you can kind of talk to them about how ridiculous that theory is. So in my first book, Disproving Christianity, I did a lot of work to debunk biblical literalism, so I can kind of point to that when in future discussions. For me, like I said, it's not about proving anything. It's about asking for evidence, and when that evidence isn't there, then I'm going to not believe in it. And it's just something that I'm built with, and I'm geared toward looking for evidence and everything.
They're the ones making the claim. It's not like we're saying there's a man in the sky doing, you know, controlling everything. They're the one making that kind of claim. So the burden of proof would be on them.
Well, certainly. I mean, if I claim anything.
The book. Well, you know, it says so in the book. All right, I'm going to need a little more than that.
So there's a lot of things in a lot of other books, and older books claim different gods. So it's just,
right.
It's plain from anyone who's studied the history of religions, it's plain to see that Christianity, that Islam, that they're just other religions, other cultures, ways to explain the unknown that have now become part of their culture. And that's the problem with the spread of religion, is that it's so cultural, and it's something that they want their children to be Christians because they don't want their children to burn in hell. So it's built into the religion
right,
to spread it on, to spread it. So it's something that will just keep happening in that culture. So unless you point out to people that these things have no basis in reality and they're not factually accurate, then they're just going to continue thinking them.
Well, let's talk about raising children, not atheist children, basically, in a religious world. It's a difficult process for them because it can leave them feeling alienated when everybody else is God bless us and, you know, God everywhere. What do you what advice do you have to parents who are wanting to raise their child as a non-believer?
In my I actually addressed this question in the back of the book. I have about 20 frequently asked questions, and I put that question in there because so many people ask me, isn't raising your children as atheists a form of religious indoctrination, or how would you raise your children? But the simple, since atheism is not a religion, the simple answer is no, it's not. But my advice to people, to parents, is not to raise atheists, although that's probably what would happen as a result of my advice. But I think it's important to give children a healthy dose of religious education early on, teaching them a broad range of comparative mythology and religion from a phenomenological approach, like I studied in college. And if you study those, it's really harder to be religious because they're also similar at their fundamental level. And each organization has its cult beginnings and its false prophets, and they began as local and cultural myths before being applied to a global context. And they're almost always spread through a combination of violence and proselytization. So by learning about the origins of those myths and the histories of those myths, children can see all religions as part of the same phenomenon and not see one as inherently superior to all others.
Well, even if you are going to believe in God, you should be exposed to different religions to determine what feels right to you. But to think that just because your parents were born into something, that means that's your belief system, isn't really true. Everybody has their own individual belief within their concept of right and wrong. So they should test out different religions to see which one makes more sense to them, even if they're going to continue to believe.
Yeah, and I wouldn't phrase it as a testing out, like trying on different religions,
yeah.
but just studying them, just learning about them. Even people ask me what I recommend to Christians who are on the fence about whether or not they're going to continue being Christians or be non-religious, and they ask me what advice I give to them or any religious person, and my only advice is to look skeptically, look critically at their own text. And if you look at the Bible, you look at the Quran, and you look at any religious, any other holy text, and if you look critically and study the contradictions and look at how much sense it makes and look at how little evidence there is to support the claims, and you'll just realize that it's all made up.
Yeah, it takes a while to open up your mind and begin processing, because there's so many things that are so deep in there that there's so part of your normal being that you don't even realize that you're not questioning it. So it's really, you've got to take a very serious look at your thought processes. And where do you think that good and evil come from? Like you said about the concept of being good without God, that's a very foreign concept to some people.
Yeah, a lot of people just see it as impossible to be good without God. And they think that the word atheist, if you identify as an atheist, that means that they literally believe that you're evil, that you're possessed by Satan, or that you're working for Satan. It seems so ridiculous to us, but people really do believe that. So I do talk about being good without God in the book, and how and basically the separation of people who say that you have to believe in Jesus. It's normally a Christian thing. They say you have to believe in Jesus to be even moral, and that's just something that's not supported by facts or studies or anything, really.
Now, when you have a person who's religious and they're seeing their loved ones in their mind turn their back on God, what kind of conversation can you have with them that'll help them not freak out as much? And yet, when you're going in two different directions, you're basically questioning their belief system on every level while saying you still love them. So it's a very hard conversation to have.
Yes, it's a hard line to walk, and people really do take atheism or non-belief as an affront to their God or their creator, and I can't count the
right.
number of times that I've been accused of hating God or hating believers just because I don't believe. So it's not surprising that that's the case, because you're telling them, by saying that you're an atheist, you're telling them that everything they've ever been taught since childhood, that all of their role models taught them, that their family and friends taught them, that it's all wrong and that it's all just bullshit, basically. And so when you do that, it's natural that it's going to be a confrontational process. But think about it from the other perspective, too, because believers are also telling you you're wrong, but they're also telling you that you're going to burn in hell for eternity.
Exactly.
So that's a little more extreme. But in the book, I do talk about ways to handle those conflicts in a more friendly manner and not resort to insults or anything like that. But there's also a chapter on extreme situations where you might warrant a secular therapist or counselor, and I have references for those in there as well.
Yeah, I like the way you stay calm, even with your discussions on your page all the time. No
mm-hmm.
matter what kind of craziness they come at you, you just stay very logical and matter-of-fact on it and don't seem to get offended. Like a lot of people, they immediately get offended and it turns into a very ugly confrontation.
Yep, I realize that when people write mean things to me online, it's usually a knee-jerk reaction because I'm challenging their faith and they're not comfortable with that. So I don't take it personally, and I don't think anything is resolved when there's angry words. So I generally
right.
try to be as nice as possible and as friendly as possible and just say exactly what I'm here to say. And say, if you're going to claim these things, then I'm just asking for the evidence behind it, and that's it.
How do you have such a professional maturity at your age when I've seen people like in their 60s and all that can't even grasp the professionalism that you seem to display all the time? Where does that come from?
I'm not 100% sure. I really enjoy what I do. I enjoy learning about religions, and I've just always been respectful of people's religions. As I said, I really do enjoy studying religion from a phenomenological approach, so I have nothing against religion itself. It's just when it takes its more extreme forms or inhibits the rights of others that I become an activist against it. So I don't hate any believers, and I don't want to think that I don't want them to think that I have anything against them. So I just treat them like I would treat a friend or anyone else that I'm having a casual conversation
right.
with. I don't think that religion has to be an inherently confrontational topic, because although it's something that people hold so tightly and have held that way their entire lives, it's also just another part of humanity, and it really doesn't affect whether you're atheist or religious or Christian. It doesn't affect who you are as a person in general, and so I like to
right.
point that out as often as possible.
And I try to keep that in mind as well, because I usually have people confronting me, and I look at them and I'm like, it's not you. You are a very decent person within your life. It's the concept that you're telling me I've got to believe now as well is where we start having issues. Like,
mm-hmm.
I have this woman who posted about have a God day on my
yep.
wall, knowing clearly that I don't believe. And those are the kind of levels where I think the conflict comes from, where you're clearly stating what your belief is, and people around you are dismissing it as irrelevant. Because we are a minority within the spectrum of Christianity in the United States. Even the president is swearing in on Bibles, you know. And
mm-hmm. Today,
and,
in fact.
Exactly. And to me, that's offensive. And to other people, they have no problem with it. And they're like, oh, this Bible is from Lincoln, and this, it's the Bible. And he's our president of all of us. And in my mind, nobody in a political office should be even mentioning God whatsoever or swearing in on anything that is religious.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they definitely, by the separation of church and state, they probably shouldn't be. But it
right.
is a traditional thing that's gone on for a long, 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 long time, and it's something that's not going to go away overnight. Although I do believe that as our as our country takes the cue from other countries and their secular governments and actually adopts the separation of church and state that it was founded on and that has really done well for us, I think that that stuff will kind of fall by the wayside over time.
Yeah, it's definitely a fight that is going to take a long time to get there, but I think the next couple of generations hasn't had the level of indoctrination that my generation has. So I think these concepts will be easier for them to embrace than the people 40-plus that were exposed to a lot heavier indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
So what are other atheist issues that make it important for people to come out and show their numbers?
Well, like I said before, if a religious family, if there's a very religious family and they might not understand what atheism is, they might think that it's evil, they might think that you're going to hell if you're an atheist, but then their son, their daughter, their aunt, someone in the family who's always been good and kind and respectful, if that person is to come out as an atheist and admit that they're not a believer like the rest of their family, it really helps to change those attitudes toward atheism, towards non-belief, and you can see that it's possible for anybody to be an atheist. It doesn't make them evil. It just means that they have looked critically at their religion and chosen to and decided that the evidence wasn't there to support belief. So it really helps a lot of ways, but the main things I like to focus on are that it changes the attitudes, dispels rumors about atheists, and it also more accurately represents in surveys and therefore in political power.
How important is it to understand the battle between separation of church and state?
Well, in America, that's huge. I mean, that's something that is one of the number one reasons that people become activists against religion is because it has impeded progress and it has infiltrated our government in so many different ways when it really shouldn't. And then you look at areas in Europe where they have a completely secular government and everything works great in that regard. They don't try to shove God into anything and they don't have God on their money. And things like that are really difficult in America. But, like I said, hopefully over time those things will kind of fall by the wayside as the secularization of America continues. And that's what I'm hoping to help be the catalyst for that with this new book and with books that I'm going to come out with in the future.
Oh, so you're writing more books, huh?
Yeah, I have a few projects that I'm looking at now. I haven't decided which one to take on next, but there are definitely some things in the works.
Oh, definitely keep me posted. I love all the stuff you do. It's very important and it's well laid out, and I think it's a great resource for anyone who is questioning how to come out. So,
well, thank you. I really appreciate. I really like being on the show. It's second time on, so I'll in the future look forward to being on again.
Oh, definitely. Is there anything, any topic you need to bring on, just let me know, and we'll come on and talk about it. Now,
greatly appreciate it. Thank
you. Let me move on to what are some of the common things that you heard during an argument with believers or non-believers, such as Jesus still loves you?
Yeah, I do address Jesus loves you, I'll pray for you. I talk about that stuff in the book because those are common religious objections, and those are things that are generally not well thought out. They're just repeated over and over again, and if you actually look at them, they don't make much sense. So take Jesus loves you, for instance. While that's fine for somebody who believes in Jesus, if you're telling a non-believer that, that's not going to affect them at all. That person's more concerned with the love that they feel from their friends and family and
right.
Not the love of a being that they don't believe in. So it's just something that doesn't make sense unless you're trying to be passive-aggressive or rude to a non-believer, which also is sometimes the case, but obviously hoping to avoid that as much as possible. So there are a lot of objections, and that's actually also why I did the frequently asked questions in the back to kind of address some of those, because doing this atheist activism for the last 5 years or so, I've experienced a lot of every type of hate mail and question and objection. So I have a lot of those. I put the top 20 or so in the back of the book with my answers so that people who are reading can kind of help develop their own responses based on that.
Well, the whole concept that Jesus still loves you, and oh, by the way, you're going to burn in hell for eternity, it's a very strange thing for those two concepts to coexist within somebody's mind, and it still feel logical to them, which is kind of the indoctrination process.
Yep, exactly. They don't see Jesus or God as the one punishing you for your non-belief. They see you as punishing yourself for not believing. But when the evidence just isn't there, I mean, it would be one thing if God or gods were to openly expose themselves and have concrete evidence for their existence. It would be something completely different. But because there's not, punishing someone to an eternity in hell for simply not being convinced doesn't seem like something that an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving deity would do.
Yeah, the evidence of the, even if there is a God, the evidence of this God being a loving God can be debated within itself.
Yep, or that it's an, I mean, really the three tenets of the Christian, the Judeo-Christian God, the omnipotence, omnibenevolence, and omniscience, those three tenets, they really don't go together, and none of them can be proven by just basically looking at the world around you.
Now, and even, I mean, in the Bible, he's very jealous and vindictive with very little mercy. I mean, they always talk about him being so merciful. But I see in there that he acts very quickly and very severe judgments on very minor things. I mean, he's kind of the ultimate abusive father figure in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And the character of the God, especially in the Old Testament, often just written off by Christians. They say that that's not something that they believe in because it's the Old Testament, or they say that it's just something that doesn't apply to their religion, but they don't realize that their religion teaches that Jesus Christ is that God incarnate, that he came to earth in a human form, but that it's still the same God, the same jealous God, the same vindictive God, the same God that,
right,
that created evil, the same God that said that homosexuality is an abomination, the same God that says that women can't speak in church. They just don't tie them all together, and they kind of, there's some cognitive dissonance there.
Yeah, can you explain that term? Because that's a show, actually, I want to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, in this case, basically, I'm just talking about people who don't see the obvious problems in their theories. It's the feeling of discomfort when you're holding two conflicting opinions or ideas. So they don't see that they conflict, and then they get uncomfortable when they slowly begin to realize that.
Yeah, when it's challenged, their mind just does not compute that it's the conflicting ideas, because they're so indoctrinated into that being a fact. And the religion itself is not wide open to questioning, which, again, leads to the concept of faith, which means I have no clue what the answer is, so you're just going to have to trust me on it.
Yep, and historically, most Christians, St. Augustine, Pascal, a lot of Luther, a lot of well-known Christians were enemies of reason because they saw it as the enemy of faith. So they saw that religion, that faith and logic couldn't coexist, and that therefore you must choose faith. And that's something that I fundamentally disagree with.
Yeah, religion itself is supposed to be designed to help you be a moral compass throughout the world. Is religion here to serve us, or are we here to serve this God? Because this God has a lot of criteria for us that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with our own personal development as a human being.
Nope, it all has to do with what that religion was, what the culture that religion was created in was dealing with at that time. So the people who created those religions, each religion at that time period, they put the issues that were most important to them. So if they were having issues with seafood poisoning, for instance, they might say that seafood's an abomination. So those types of things get worked into there because of the culture and because of the time period. But people don't realize that our morals, our moral compasses, everything that about us as humans as animals changes over time. And so although 500 years ago and in the Bible, slavery might have been completely acceptable, now it's considered universally immoral, and that's because of the evolution of our own moral construct. So a religion created today might have that in there, whereas the Christian religion obviously does not.
Right. It is weird that they can dismiss certain aspects of it, and then other things are just as antiquated, they embrace fully.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, I can see where it would be interesting to you to try to figure out how people's mindset works, where they can believe these type of things.
It's very interesting, especially seeing when their faith is met with another faith, a similar but different faith. They often don't know how to react. They just think that it's heresy, and they just think that it's against God, but they don't realize that it's the exact same thing. It's another culture's attempt to explain the unknown.
Right. And it seems like the timelines in the Bible are kind of subjective depending on what it is they're trying to prove or not prove. So they can play with the timelines a lot. It's very confusing stuff when you really sit down and try to break it down as you have.
I did a lot of that in Disproving Christianity and broke down, for instance, if you're talking about timelines, you look at people's ages in the Bible, they live to be 800, 300, 600 years old, and you can count the years from the beginning of time until Jesus' time, which according to the Bible would be something like 7,000 years. So I did a lot of that in Disproving Christianity, kind of debunking biblical literalism and looking at the Bible and showing that it's not a text that's relevant to today, and it's not some transcendent word of God. It's clearly written by Bronze Age and Iron Age men, and that's pretty obvious.
Now, who is King James, and why is there a King James version?
Just like there are a lot of translations of the Bible, people, especially kings, clergymen alike, though, commission their own translations. And King James Version is considered by a lot of people, a lot of Christians, to be the definitive translation, although it's pretty clear that there are things in there that were input specifically by King James that weren't relevant to earlier to the people who actually wrote the text. But it's still the most commonly used version of the Bible, and it's still one that a lot of people who use it are strictly and firmly say that that's the only version you can use. I used the King James Version in Disproving Christianity for all the footnotes and citations, and I used it just because it's the version that's the most used in the world. So that's why I chose to use that one. But there are so many translations that it would be impossible to satisfy everyone in choosing one.
And I don't think people really realize that it is a version of it, that it's not, you know, they think this is the Bible, everything within it is true, and they skip over the part where it's a version of a king, which is funny because Americans are very steadfast on not following any kings. We're Americans, we don't have kings. Now leave me alone, I'm going to read King James Version of the Bible. But they have their own agenda when they're doing that version of what they're trying to get people to believe a certain way for their political agendas as well. So the book
is and then a lot of newer versions of the Bible since the King James are trying to change it for their own benefit as well. For instance, they'll change the word slave to servant in a more modern translation, so it doesn't seem as though God is
Christian
allowing
life.
Slavery. Although it's, it clearly was the case. I mean, the word slave didn't change, so yeah, they were slaves, and they were allowed to. Slavery was condoned within the Old Testament and the New Testament, actually.
Yeah, the Living Bibles that kind of soften it up and rephrase it in more of a modern way. Which, you know, the more and more you translate something, the more you lose whatever its original origin was.
And the best part about it is that they claim that the reason for these retranslations, the reason that they're necessary, is because of mistranslations in the first place. So they're saying translations are so bad that they accidentally called these slaves in the first place, so we're going to change it to servant because that's more correct, because but they don't realize that they're the ones actually doing the poor
translation. That would have a lot more credibility if we didn't actually have slaves. You know, like historically there was no slaves, and you know, but historically Christianity has been used in a lot of brutal events.
Oh, certainly, and the slave trade was really important. I mean, Christians were huge proponents behind the slave trade when it was first starting out in America, and that's something that the slaves and then the later freed slaves were tied to, and still, and their descendants are still tied to the religion, because it's something that was used to justify their position when they came to America in the first place.
Right, and they didn't have a choice at the time, but that if that's what the slave master wanted them to learn, that's what they learned, and it's still deeply rooted within their community. And I see different aspects of their community trying to break that down. You know, Chris Rock says if you believe in Christianity, you have a very short memory. He phrased it a little differently, but
yeah.
I won't say. But, and it's true. It's like that's part of the indoctrination. A person who enslaved you gave you that religion. That might be an indicator right there that it may not benefit you completely. Yeah.
It should be, but forced conversions really work far too well, whether it's in slavery or Native American cultures or during the Crusades.
Right.
There are always times when people came, conquered a land, and gave them their religion, and those religions stuck around because they indoctrinate their children, they send them to special schools, they take away all their religion, their spiritual texts, whatever they do have, and they just 100% replace it, and it really works far too well, actually.
It really does, because I do a lot of work with abuse survivors from Native American communities, First Nation, Ireland, Australia, and all of them suffered the same type of thing, where the children were removed and completely indoctrinated by force and brutality into
mm-hmm.
this belief system. And it only takes a couple of generations to completely wipe out a culture and convert their children into a new belief system. If you have complete control over those children, then it doesn't take as long as people think.
That's sad but true.
And those communities now are kind of a mixture of the way it was before. The Christians now that were converted, and variations of both. And they're trying to figure out what all that means now. As you're trying to figure out how to find your way back to what existed before, it's almost impossible to get back to the original root once it's got so deeply in.
Yeah, and sometimes it is impossible, because that's exactly what the people forcing the religion are trying to do, is to make it impossible to recover that old faith that is a devil-worshipping
language,
faith.
Language, everything.
Against God, yeah, exactly.
And that's why I'm so against missionary work of any kind, because regardless of how good the missionary person is and how much they intend on doing good, the religion doctrine itself that's so deeply ingrained in them tells them to save these people in spite of any belief that they may have, that in order for them to go to heaven, you need to save them and bring them into Christianity. And they will do that to the complete extinction of that person's real culture and think that they're doing good. But so that's why I'm always fighting missionary work. What is your feeling about missionary work?
I am also against missionary work. I mean, there are a lot of times when people come to a land that really needs resources, they need food, they need water, and instead they bring Bibles, and that's just something that I've always been against.
Well, they also create systems where your food is dependent on receiving Christian belief systems, for instance, church services, and then you get to eat or you get whatever resources you need only after you've sat through these services. So you're using poverty as a weapon to convert people.
Yep.
And that, of course, sends me right over the edge many times. Well, what I want to do is I want to take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll keep on talking.
Cool.
All right. This is another Shelley Siegel song, I Don't Believe in Fairies.
I don't believe in fairies. I don't believe.
Conversation is in the middle of something, and it gives me more time to wrap up. So just letting you know ahead of time. David, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right. I would like like to talk about this Christian entitlement, because to me that is a big issue in the world, that Christianity being a dominant part of our society, there's a lot of entitlement that seems to go with it, like the government is theirs and we're just kind of a second-class citizen. Have you experienced that kind of thing?
Definitely, in a government where majority rules and 85%+ of people are Christian, then that's pretty much the situation that we're in. Unfortunately for Christians, they don't realize that Islam is going through a much, much, much more rapid growth right now and will probably be the most dominant religion soon. But that'll end all the arguments from Christians that because it's the most popular religion, it's necessarily true, which I hear far too often. They say that so many people believe it has to be true, but that's simply not the case because people believe pretty much anything, and it doesn't make
it true. Historically speaking, people can be forced to believe really anything.
Yeah, 90%+ of...
Yeah. Go ahead.
90%+ of ancient Greeks believed in the Greek pantheon of gods, and that didn't make them true, so I don't see how it's any different.
Right. Now then, are you familiar with the doctrine of discovery?
No, I'm not.
Well, it basically divided up the world and allowed a belief system that God gave the world to Christians to come and take as they want everybody else there. But just kind of holding it until Christians got there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you came to a land that didn't have Christians, and you were free to do whatever you wanted to the people, Native Americans as an example.
Things like manifest destiny, they think that,
yes,
that
it's
God,
all the same,
Christian God
the same
gave them
type
their...
of thing.
Yep.
And in doing so, that's the reason why it's the dominant religion. But that doesn't mean it has any merit in truth. It just means that the power that came to overthrow the other belief systems was stronger at the time to make
yep,
it so.
Yep, it means
that's
that it
all
received
it means.
It means that it received the right amount of political power, the right amount of kings and rulers in the past became Christians, and it shows that forced conversions work really well, and that's about it.
That's all it shows. It doesn't have any credence toward its validity. It just shows that, you know, when you out-muscle other people, then you can force all kind of things on them that they don't like, religion
being
one of them.
But Christians don't realize that Islam, like I said before, it's going through a time in its period that Christianity went through as well, of a very violent time. But a very expansive time as well, and Islam's the newer religion, and it's kind of just finding its ground there. So, in my opinion, it's going to keep going in that direction.
And people don't realize, the powers that are higher up in Christianity do realize that it's a numbers game. As far
mm-hmm.
as world dominance, Christianity is very much focused on world dominance and having God in every household in the world. So it is a very competitive doctrine, and that's why so many people go to different countries to try to convert those people as well. Now, I don't see Muslims
yep.
knocking on my door but I see Christians knocking on my door all the time.
Well, they do something a little bit different. For example, well, you're not in the Middle East. You're in Southern United States, so you're
yeah.
going to interact with a lot more Christians, but in areas in the Middle East, they outlaw being a Christian. They outlaw being anything other than a Muslim. And by doing that, that's really the more aggressive way to go, and that's what Christianity
right.
did in the past. So because Christianity
yeah.
did that in the past, it worked really well. Now Islam's doing it in the Middle East, and it's also working really well. They have 90%+ of people who say that they believe in Islam, and whether or not they actually do, they say it because they're afraid of being
right.
punished by, in some areas, by death for saying that they're an atheist.
And that is a very much a danger, because that's happened where people have been put to death for their belief system, correct?
Yeah, and it's still, even in Europe, in the UK, I think it was in 1400, the death penalty was taken away for those who say that they're atheists. It's just something that has always been there, and in the Middle East, they're even ramping up their punishment in some areas for non-believers. So in the book, I include a chapter called Extreme Situations, where I really try to outline the fact that in some areas, they don't have the option to be an atheist. It's just not something they can admit without
right.
being sent to prison or anything like that. So I put in there a chapter on that just in case people feel like I'm trying to send everyone out yelling that they're atheist, whether or not it's safe, and that's just not the case.
Right. Now tell me about this clothing, secular clothing that you have.
Yeah, I started a store called thesecularstore.spreadshirt.com. It's the secular store, and basically I just had some short quotes from some of my books and from some of my online conversations, and I just thought they'd look good on T-shirts. So I made some T-shirts online, and I wear them all the time. My favorite one says, "Skepticism is a virtue, faith is a crutch," but there's also some fun ones, "Keep Thor and Thursday," and I say, "Oh my God," when something is unbelievable. So I really try to make them fun, but also have a point as well.
Now, how can people get in touch with you if they want to have you come and speak? Is that something you do a lot of?
Yep, I did a speaking engagement in Riverside yesterday and your podcast today, and anyone who wants to reach me can get me at david@davidgmcafee.com.
And you're open to traveling, or do you just stay within California?
I'm actually looking to go up into Washington soon as well. Next year there's something in Ohio, a convention in Ohio that I'm in preliminary talks scheduling something there. So as long as there is a way to get travel expenses taken care of, then I'm happy to travel and talk about my book and talk about my experiences. And I'm really looking forward to expanding into the conference circuit soon, which I haven't done in the past.
Yeah, that would definitely be a great way for you to get the word out. Now, do you offer signed books at all?
Do I sign? Is that what you said?
Yeah, do you offer signed books? Are they available?
Yes, I do, actually. I have every time I do an event, I do signed books afterwards, but then I also sell online, too. So for $20 for U.S. shipping or $25 for international shipping, you can send payments to PayPal ID, my email address, david@davidgmcafee.com, and include your shipping address, and I can send the signed book out within the week.
And now, I saw what you said to like you on Facebook, so you have... Tell people how to contact you on Facebook and your web pages.
Yep. My website is davidgmcafee.com. That's a pretty easy one. On Facebook, I'm at facebook.com/authordavidgmcafee, and that's where I do a lot of my daily conversations and promoting and spreading the word about the book. So if you're really interested in following me, that's a good place to start.
And you always have some discussion going. I know some people just kind of create these pages, and they don't interact much, but you're a very active community.
Yep, I try to make my page, like you just said, I try to make it a community for people who are coming out as atheists or people who are just interested in discussing friendly topics regarding religion and things and other spiritual matters. So it always stays calm, at least from my end, and it's a really fun page.
Now, your book is available in paperback and Kindle as well, right?
Yep, both available on Amazon, and the Disproving Christianity is available on both as well. And the audiobooks are coming out in the next month or so.
Are you going to be doing the reading of them?
I am indeed, so look forward to that.
Wow, you're just expanding into all kind of different formats. You're very good at networking. How did you learn so much about networking?
I wouldn't consider myself great at networking. I think that I just go with what people ask of me. So I get a lot of people asking me for audiobooks because they want to listen to it in a car, or they just don't like to read. And because my publisher offered that option to me, I decided that I would take the opportunity to do it myself because I know the book better than anyone else. So I think it'd be better that way.
Absolutely. There's inflections when the author reads a book that just can't exist with someone who hasn't done the work ahead of time. So it's always best when you can to read your own book.
Exactly. I'll be doing both.
Yeah. I know you have another appointment. You're always out there getting the word out. So I want to thank you for coming on the show. And this link is available to be shared and listened to at any time. So just because you didn't catch it at airtime, it's always there for you to listen to. So be sure and check it out and spread it within your networks.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. And we're always here when you have stuff to talk about. Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. Talk soon.
All righty. All right. We're going to end the show with another Shelly Siegel song, Saved. Everybody have a good evening and thank you for coming.
Say that I need to be saved. Stay with me to dip. God, his way. Never question.